coming. I think it's time to call the meeting to order. Stephanie?
Joyce Still.
Here.
David Happ.
Here.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell.
Here.
Mike Smith. Deb Roush.
Here.
Do we have any additions to the agenda today? That's a no, I guess. Citizen input.
Good morning, everyone. Dale Morrissey, Developmental Services Center. Cheryl, welcome back to the community. I thought this might be the best place on the agenda. I talked with Lynn a little bit. Have any of you seen the Chicago Tribune articles? If you haven't, Lynn, if you possibly could maybe forward them to them, or they can Google them or whatever. I'll send them to you. Yeah. Anyway, a reporter from the Chicago Tribune worked for over a year and a half on an article, and the target was Scylla's or the group homes. And I'll let you read the articles yourself so you can come to some conclusions. One, there's some reality there. There are a few bad service providers out there, and that brought light to that, and that's good, because if there's bad service providers that are harming people, they should be brought to light and they should be shut down immediately. And what it shows is one particular provider that was given warnings 3 or 4 times and no action was taken, and it hurt people bad. And so, but the other thing is there wasn't balance to the article. There are some actually good providers in there that are put in a situation that, for example, particularly one that takes some of the toughest individuals to serve that have significant either behavioral or medical needs. And, of course, under the current discharge procedure, some of them it takes 6-8 months and you can't get them to the service that they really need. And so then they get it in harm's way. And so actually there's a couple providers in there that are portrayed pretty bad, and they actually are good providers. And so what I'm saying to you is the article – you need to see it. The editorial board, though, then of the Tribune did do two follow-up editorials that did say, and that's the good news, I've been coming to you for 4 years talking about the staff shortage and the wage issue that's now a statewide issue. It brought that to light. And it finally, it said that the staff shortage, anywhere from 25 to 35% staff shortage in all these homes is one of the real reasons that people are at risk. And I've told you that here. That's why haven't been able to open the Muhammad Group Home for the last 2 years, but because people are working overtime or so short-staffed. So there was a hearing yesterday, the Senate hearing yesterday, that lasted 2.5 hours, and it's the first of, I think, that'll be several, where the secretary responded to that. So anyway, I won't go on and on, but I encourage you to look at it, because I think the good news is if there's bad providers, they should be shut down. My real concern is they're going to put money first into more oversight when they've doubled the amount of overpay, instead of putting it in where it needs to be, in staff wages and getting rid of the staff shortage so we can serve more people, the current people, safely, and continue to expand services in smaller settings in the community. But I think that's the good news. I really believe from this that when and if they ever do a budget, that because of the by the way, the campaign we started 18 months ago, can you imagine if we hadn't started this campaign bringing it to light at the state level, it would have been reaction. This is the reason it's the problem. But before, because we were out in front of that, I think that people do realize that there is a staff shortage. And even the secretary had said that yesterday. Now, he did a balanced approach because he didn't want to get it in front of the governor, but he finally did say that it was a priority and a need and a need to be done. So I guess what I'm sharing with you, please read it. Because I think it's critical, but the good light is bad providers will hopefully be shown upon. Maybe we can push them back so they don't. For example, and I'll end here. They want they now transparency. The Secretary Dismas is saying he wants to all unsubstantiated cases should put everybody's names out there and be known. Well, there's such a thing as transparency, but can you imagine how difficult we'll have in hiring Scylla service providers? We have one consumer that weekly says that a staff strikes him, and everybody knows, but we report that. We follow the law exactly. If anything, we become, you'd consider an over-reporter, but we report that every time. Well, if you measure that to say because people report, would you want to be the staff person that every time you say that you get hit, that you report that your name's in this registry? So they've got to bring some balance to this. If it's an unsubstantiated cases like that, we really shouldn't be. We should have a way of keeping scorecard of that, but not putting people, because staff just won't come to work for us if their name's going to be put like that. Why would they be put under that scrutiny? So that's why I share that with you, because I think we all need to be looking at it, a balanced approach to protect our people, which is number one, but provide quality services in a safe way is number two. So thank you for letting me share that with you.
Thank you, Dale, for bringing that up, the Tribune article in particular, because that was my president's comment today, and you did a better job than I would have. Thank you. Any other citizen input? Okay. Dr. Fowler, is there a CCMHB input today?
Not today, thanks.
Okay, so now we come to approval of last month's minutes. I'd like to make a motion to accept them as written and presented. Is there a second? Aye. Minutes are approved. I have no additional comments today. And Executive Director's report is next. Lynn?
Well, the Tribune article is a good place to start. So we had the quarterly conference of our state association on Thursday and Friday last week, and Director Fenton was one of our guest speakers, as was Ronnie Cohn, the Ligas court monitor. So they provided us with updates, lots and lots of detail. We also had Tony Pulowski from the ARC, who's retiring, was the facilitator of our discussions. And he and Greg Fenton provided this information on people waiting. This is statewide, this is not broken down by county. We can look at county information later. But I thought you might like this. You know, we also, during the course of these conversations, hear lots of things that are interesting, but just predictions, like that we're going to be living with stopgap budgets for a long time. Well, who knows if that's really true. There's also lots of discussion about the future of the Independent Service Coordination contract process, and it's not clear to me. Maybe it's clear to the people who are directly involved in that, but it has changed so many times in the last month that I'm no longer able to track what's happening. So we just hope for the best. Some are speculating that the cuts or that the purpose of consolidating or regionalizing the ISCs might have been to save money to pay for the DSP wage increase. That's just speculation again, but it's possible because DD is just one line in the DHS budget. So the money, there's not talk of infusion of $300 million to support the DSP wage increase. So it's possible that they were just looking at other places to take the money. So relatedly, so there's the state information. Did it make it all the way to you? Okay, and I'll put the extras over there for other people. So we did get lots of really good updates about what's going on at the state. We heard from people from Ohio, and then people speaking to the national picture for DD. And related to that, I'll be going in late February to the National Association's Legislative and Policy Conference, and one of the speakers at our meeting last week was the chairperson of the DD committee for the National Association, and we're preparing a document to take with us to talk to legislators at that conference. So here are these are the first draft that he put together for us to take with us if we are lucky enough to make some appointments during that conference. We were so fortunate last year. No one really knows what to expect now. I think it's probably fair to say of all the pieces of the Affordable Care Act that might stop, parity is probably the most vulnerable. And I don't think that we'll be looking at DD services in Illinois, which are funded through Medicaid, will probably not be going into managed care anytime soon, and that might be a blessing. So I think that's – we have a presentation today and lots of business to discuss, so I should stop unless you have questions. All right. Oh, so yes, if you have any comments on this draft, let me know. There's time for us to make this more relevant to us. If there's anything missing that's important to stakeholders here, please share with me and we'll modify the draft. Thanks.
Very good. Thanks, Lynn. Chandra?
I just wanted to thank you for the support for the social work students, and they have completed the resource guide. There's some edits that need to be made, but you'll get a copy of it in January.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any questions for me?
Moving along, number 10, agency information. Okay, new business. The first item on our agenda is the transition supports for youth. We have representatives of the Champaign County Transition Planning Committee here. They're going to report on existing supports for young people transitioning from school to adult life.
Hi, my name is Linda Tortorelli. I represent, today, I'm representing the Champaign County TPC, Transition Planning Committee. I've sat on this board for, I don't know, a long time, as a parent representative, as a representative of the autism program, and as a representative of Community Choices. So today we have a three-part presentation. Jim Mayer, I'll let each one of you introduce yourselves, is going to talk about the TPC, the history of why we have them, kind of who sits on them. Annette Becker from Developmental Services Center will talk about the activities that we actually do here in the county. And then I'm going to take you through a presentation on kind of a snapshot in time, perspectives that we gathered from school administrators, teachers, parents, and agencies about what they say is the current situation for transitioning to adult life.
Okay, so as Linda said, I'm Jim Mayer. Some of you know me. I work with the Rural Champaign County Special Education Cooperative. My title is Transition Specialist, so that's why I serve on the part of why I serve on the Transition Planning Committee. And the reason I'm here, Annette is our current chairperson of the TPC. Linda is our current secretary, and I'm a past frequent chairperson, is why I'm here to talk about history. Right, I've been with the TPC for the past 15 years in Champaign County, and prior to that for about 10 years in, I was in Piatt County prior to this, there with the Mental Health Center. So so I'm going to talk some history of TPCs in Illinois and here locally, and then turn it over to Annette and Linda. So I've given you several handouts. First, there's one that just says Illinois Interagency Collaboration Transition Planning Committees. So that was a document that went statewide to TPCs. It was put out by the Division of Rehab Services. It was a 2001 update. And to give you a little history on TPCs in Illinois, they were created in 1990 by Illinois Public Act 86-1218. And the Division of Rehab Services was appointed by our state legislature to be the lead agency for these. And typically, you'll see them. Some of them are a single county, as we are in Champaign, and others are multi-county, as in Macon Piatt is a combined county TPC. They tend to follow where the Division of Rehab Services offices are, which often serve a multi-county area. So sometimes it'll be a multi-county committee. Other times, like ours, we're kind of fortunate, I think, that we just have to focus on Champaign County. And so I've given you just basically the first couple pages of that document that was prepared for new members of TPCs. mostly because it gives you the six duties that we're charged with as a TPC. And so I'm just going to briefly cover those so you have an idea of what we're about as a TPC. The Public Act stated that TPCs should, number one, identify current transition services, programs, and funding sources provided within the community for secondary and post-secondary aged youth with disabilities and their families, as well as the development of strategies to address unmet needs. Secondly, to facilitate the development of transition interagency teams to address present and future transition needs of individual students on their individual education plans. Thirdly, to develop a mission statement that emphasizes the goals of integration and participation in all aspects of community life for persons with disabilities. Fourthly, to provide for the exchange of information, such as appropriate data, effectiveness studies, special projects, exemplary programs, and creative funding of programs. Fifthly, develop consumer in-service and awareness training programs in the local community. And finally, to assist in staff training for individual transition planning and student transition needs assessment. So that's kind of the statewide charge for TPCs. The next handout I'd like to draw your attention to is just the one that's headed Champaign County Transition Planning Committee. And what that contains, the first sheet covers our mission statement, our statement of purpose and vision statement, plus our website, if you'd like to peruse that at some point. And then it contains a bunch of documents of recent activities that our TPC has been involved in, which kind of gives you an idea of, again, our history of what we've become engaged in, how we've taken our charge on. So just to look at that first sheet, I'll cover our mission statement in Champaign County. Our mission is to collaborate with students with disabilities, families/support systems, educators, and adult service providers to create opportunities to improve the quality of life of students as they transition from school to adult life. Further, to advocate for full participation of these individuals as they access services that will impact community and family life, including employment, education, training, housing, transportation, independent living, recreation, and leisure. So that's our local mission statement. We came up with that early in the 2000s, the basics of that, and then we had a strategic planning session in, I think, 2009, where we kind of tweaked that a bit, and at that time we came up with our statement of purpose and vision statement as well. So that that gives you our local mission, and then following that, you know, just to talk about some of the activities that we have, you know, chosen to become engaged in to fulfill that mission. First, there's just a handout we developed recently on transition planning tips, covering the PUNS, PASS agents, SILA, and the Home Based Support Services program, because there were a lot of sort of misunderstandings about the importance of that system for individuals with developmental disabilities coming out of high school. Next, you see we provide a job coach training countywide, and we actually invite not only school-based job coaches to that training, but also adult service job coaches who may be newer to the field have come to that over the years, and we provide that generally every fall. Start of the school year, usually in late August. So that's been an activity of our, an ongoing activity of our committee. Then you see a handout that talks about a transition info night that we had last spring for parents. And that one really focused especially on needs of families of students with developmental disabilities. And that's something that we often do about every other year. Is a parent night. The next handout covers a transition roundtable, which we usually have every other year. We're planning one for this spring, actually. And the transition roundtable is an event for parents and teachers as our target audience, but also it's intended to be also for the service providers to be sitting around one big table like we are today and to learn what the other, you know, for each agency to learn what the other agencies are doing, what's current and happening in terms of youth services for youth with disabilities. So that's coming up this spring. There's another example of a teacher training, one that we put on when the state started requiring that every student with disabilities have an independent living goal in their transition plan. So that was sort of our local response to that new directive. We wanted to get information out to teachers on how to write good independent living goals and to incorporate those into to work with students and their families on incorporating those into their IEP. And I think that's the final example you have there of our local activities. Oh, other than the two booklets I gave you. Those highlight a couple of our activities. The Gold Book is a directory that we update usually about every 2 years. It's a directory of transition services in Champaign County, and so that's been an activity for many, many years of our committee, and it's a typical transition planning committee activity to have a directory. And that's available on our website as well as in the hard copy that we make available to schools countywide. And then the other sample you have is the green booklet, and that's from our youth conference. Every 2 years we hold a youth conference for juniors and seniors with disabilities countywide. So that just happened last month, November 16th, I guess it was. And we had approximately 175 students attended that, plus an additional 60 or 70 teachers and parents. And so that's an event that we hold, again, every 2 years countywide for youth with disabilities to help prepare them for adult life. And so you can kind of see from that what the content of that conference is, the different speakers that we bring in, and the topics that we cover. So I hope that gives a good historical quick summary. Any questions on that part of the presentation? Okay.
Thank you. Thank you. You covered some of mine, so that means talk short. No, that's great. That's great. Annette Becker, Developmental Services Center, but again here representing TPC. Although technically I'm the chairperson, I just want to make sure everybody knows Jim Mayer really holds TPC together. Without Jim's guidance and involvement, I don't know that we would have much of a transition planning committee here in Champaign County. And I've only participated for the last 5 years, but you know, every year I see more and more what Jim really does to hold it together. So, thank you. Wanted to give that. So our TPC starts meeting at the beginning of the school year, usually in September, and then we run every other month through May, so we have 5 meetings. And, excuse me, as, you know, Jim mentioned, we have several activities through the year, and what we do in our May meeting is look to the upcoming year and kind of set the groundwork for maybe trends, things that are happening, changes that are happening, and we set our agenda for the following year based on that. So recently, one of our meetings covered WIOA and the changes that will mean for students transitioning out of high school. And we had, DRS speak to us. Yeah, thank you. Doug Morton. Speak to us about the changes. We've had RPC speak to us about updates on the PUNS list, et cetera. And then the typical, you know, planning for the conference, planning for the roundtable. Attendance tends to be 10 to 15 people. And typically it includes Champaign, Mahomet, Urbana schools, Rural Champaign County Special Education Cooperative, Rantoul High School, Parkland, CUSR, Community Choices, Cunningham Vocational Options, DSC, DRS, PACE, RPC, TAP, CU Autism Network. And there are others also. I'm sure I didn't hit everybody, but it's a pretty well-rounded group of adult services and schools, but it really tends to be a little heavier on the school side. I think that's it. Certainly.
Can't touch the ground. They have a chair spotter. Okay, that's better. Thanks.
Feet on the ground. All right. So now I'm going to take you through this snapshot in time of what we discovered by talking to these different stakeholders in transition. We gathered 2 public meetings, where we invited school administrators, special education directors, and we had both Champaign and Urbana there, and then I was able to communicate with the Mahomet director, and then we had Jim that really represented well what's happening in the rural district. So I felt like we had a pretty good representation from kind of school administrator, school people, from their perspective what was happening. Then we held a community parent meeting, And we had 10 parents that represented 11 children. And then I also sent out a survey and received about three or four more surveys back. And also were able to talk to some parents in person, one-on-one or over the phone. So maybe had about 15 or 16 parent representations. And then was able to talk to individuals at DSC, at Community Choices, and the ISC, and got some input from PACE. So, again, it wasn't, scientific or anything, but just really try to get some anecdotes of what's happening. So here we go. So first, I think it's always a good idea to start with a little overview about what is the literature and the research telling us. And thank you to Kim Patton, who is joining us and is a doctoral candidate at U of I in special education, and she is working on transition. So it was really timely that we were able to grab her and invite her to the meetings, and she provided some of this research to me. So voices of parents, that parents prioritized paid community employment over sheltered options. They valued qualitative aspects of the workplace. Parent expectations are among the strongest predictors of employment and other post-school outcomes for young people with IDD. So according to this bit of research, they found that high school students with severe disabilities whose parents expected them to obtain post-school work were more than three times as likely to have paid jobs in the community within 2 years after leaving high school. The experience, instruction, information that are offered through schools is a very important role in students with IDD for future employment, but schools should consider carefully how to best deliver services and supports that both equip the students for workplace and raise parents' expectations for post-school employment. From this article, we found that for many parents of young adults with disabilities, involvement in their child's life does not diminish on the 21st birthday. In reality, their involvement increases in level and intensity for an extended and somewhat uncertain amount of time. And we have our own Dr. Hanley Maxwell coded in that. I thought, well, might as well grab that one. That was good stuff. So thank you for that. So what about parents' perceptions of post-school years? So from this article, we find that parents have feelings of powerlessness during high school transition meetings and helplessness when faced with unfamiliar procedures and unexpected barriers in the adult service world. It is a complex system. The school system is complex, and now we're on to the adult world that's even more complex. Parents express apprehension and fear associated with learning how to navigate through adult agency support systems and frustration with the inability to secure necessary supports in a timely manner. Parents were also concerned that the post-school program options discussed during transition meetings did not parallel their child's full capabilities. So what they were being offered was not what they felt the parents actually, that their child could actually reach their potential with those services. More research on parent involvement. The study's findings are consistent with the previous 20 years of research about parents. It seems little has changed. Parents both then and now perceive themselves as playing a fundamental part in their children's adult lives, and the tension between parental oversight and adult system provision of services continues. Parent intervention and monitoring are necessary because the current adult system is overburdened and underfunded. It's an uneasy partnership with unspecified boundaries and roles. All right, so that's what the research tells us. Now we'll find out what's happening in Champaign County. Maybe it'll make you feel better that we're not alone. So from the special education administrator's perspective, transition planning is mostly taking place on time. Transition IEPs are in place by 14 and a half, mostly. Mostly, only a simple questionnaire is being administered to parents and or students to ask questions about their desires for employment, education, and living arrangements. This contrasts with what's considered to be better practice, best practice, that there should be more formal and informal assessments. None of Champaign or Urbana are really using formal assessments on any regular basis, with the exception here of Jim Mayer, who does an excellent job with our rural schools and was able to share some assessments that they do use on a regular basis. I think I saw the administrators taking notes on some of those assessments that are available for children that have more significant developmental disabilities and might be nonverbal. So I'm hoping that maybe that kind of sparked an interest in them. They also admitted they do have these assessments, but just aren't using them. The first transition meeting.
Can I ask a question, please?
Yeah, please.
So how are they getting around the IDEA requirement for assessment for transition?
They were willing to share the questionnaire that they give out.
That's what they're using to.
That's what they're using, a questionnaire. And where do you see your child? What do you want for your child? Do you want employment? That they were bold enough to say is all they're giving.
But what about the assessment of the child?
Not happening.
So the state isn't monitoring that either.
I'll continue here and I'll tell you what they say.
Okay.
But please feel free to stop me anytime and ask questions. And then you can ask them those questions. I'm giving you the present level. Don't shoot the messenger. I think throughout this, don't shoot the messenger. Can I say that with each slide? Because you're going to hear more things that are going to make you a little uneasy and unhappy. This was a information-seeking activity. It's not my opinion. The first transition meeting where the master transition plan should be created is scheduled with the annual IEP, and that was consistently happening. No separate meetings are generally taking place for a transition IEP. That's when that master plan is supposed to be created and should take time. We should be going over those assessments that should be done and the outcomes of those, formal and informal. An annual IEP takes about an hour to an hour and a half. That's all that's allotted. So we really had some robust conversation about this. And I kept trying to respond and push this. And they finally said, Linda, why do you think these should be separate? When I thought I had answered that clearly, I finally just said, time. We don't have enough time in an hour and a half to create the master plan that's going to guide us through transition and review our annual IEPs. Yes, they're very closely related. They're not disconnected. They're very connected. But they should take time to create that master plan if we're going to do it well. That's going to guide us. All right. More perspectives. The administrators felt the transition plans and planning process met the minimum requirements of the law. So from their perspective, it was on time, they used something, and they checked all those boxes, which is those in the know are called Indicator 13, and they felt that that met those requirements. They expressed frustration with the inadequacy of the adult service system to provide access to support beyond high school. They expressed deep frustration that students are not receiving the state waiver funding necessary to pay for adult services. So in the end, a why bother attitude was expressed in regards to creating better plans if students can't access adult supports after high school. In regards to usefulness of agency presence at IEPs, we asked them that question. Generally, they felt that the agency participation at those IEPs do not provide useful information at those meetings. The exception is when an agency is invited because they've agreed to provide services, then that was helpful. But what traditionally happens in our community is that agencies are invited, and they come, and they either don't know their roles, they either don't speak, or when they're spoken to and asked questions, they're very sort of elusive as to what they might be able to provide because they don't want to ever sound like they're going to commit to that. So there is a sense of frustration with the current way that agency participation is happening. Okay, so moving on to case manager perspectives. So these are the teachers, or what we call case managers, that are special educators. So what they shared is what information parents receive is heavily dependent on what the case managers know about adult services and other supports, such as SSI, Medicaid, guardianships, trust. So, you know, if you have the schools aren't doing maybe enough to make sure that all those case managers have all the information that they might need. So it's kind of hit or miss how those case managers acquire information that might be necessary. There's not a consistent way parents are being given the information. So you might have a case manager that's doing an awesome job, and so those parents are getting more than maybe somebody that just doesn't know the system as much. So case managers tell parents to get on PUNS. But they have no power to follow through with parents. So an example that was given to me by one of the high school managers said, they've been telling this particular parent for 3 years to get their child on PUNS. Their child is now 18 at the recent IEP last week. They found out the child's still not on PUNS. So, if the ISC agents aren't coming and following through, those case managers have no authority to follow through with those families to make sure that they're doing it, other than to once a year just to remind them to do it. So here are some quotes from teacher perspectives. Many of our students, many of the students that this person was working with are not fitting nicely into the current adult services that are being offered, where they felt like 5, 6, 7 years ago that sort of kids sort of fit in better with what was available in the community, and now the needs of the kids are so complex and the services are not really fitting in with what they see children's needs are. So here, back to the research. In my experience, parents and family are the key. When a family's involved and persistent, I've seen meaningful outcomes when families, for whatever reason, can't or won't be involved, then I see a lot more of the individuals spending time at home doing nothing. I also see a lot of desperate parents who are looking for funding and services and find very little to help their child. And then when asked about what's their perspective on agency participation, generally, the way it's being done currently, it's not really very helpful. The parents are overwhelmed. They don't understand what's going on. They ask, you know, they're supposed to be asked, the parents, do you want these agencies to come? They go, oh, yeah, that's great. And then the agencies, you know, it's not just a really good use of their time to get the information to the parents. Somehow they're not understanding it, hearing it, or the right information isn't being given. So teacher perspectives more about what our students doing after high schools, it varies based on the family situation, the level of needs the individual has. Some students are staying at home, not doing anything. I've had families where a parent has to quit or change their work situation so that they can stay home with their child. We have some students who have acquired jobs or work volunteer positions independently throughout the day or week, but that's not more than 20% of those who graduate that have employment. We encourage parents to be on waiting lists for any services they are interested in at DSC and to take a tour. We also have given them information about community choices and encourage them to get involved. Here's one that says, I can think of 7 students from the young adult program who are currently at DSC, so on an average about 1 a year, but I haven't had any go in the last 2 years. DSC has been difficult for students to get into until they have home-based support funding. DSC says that if a student has funding, it doesn't guarantee that they can go to DSC, and that just because someone doesn't have funding doesn't mean that they will not take them. However, in this teacher's experience, they've only taken families once they have state funding. So this year, of the 4 graduating for this teacher, none of them are currently able to go to DSC. But that could change if they get funding. So now we move on to the parent perspective. Employment is the key here. Boy, did we have some passionate parents. I would say the tone was passion and intense frustration. Parents are very passionate about wanting more vocational experiences that would lead to meaningful community employment for their children during high school and young adult programs. And we had a range of, these were all students that have developmental disabilities, and some had pretty significant disabilities, but they believed that their children could have meaningful work experiences if they were given the chance. Parents felt that too much of the students' time was wasted doing things like hanging out at the mall and spending long periods of time on the buses, things that were not going to be lead to anything meaningful in the community. The parents who attended the meetings or filled out the surveys all wanted employment opportunities for their children after high school, and they wanted those in the community. They recognized that their parent advocacy was absolutely crucial to getting the staff to buy into employment as a realistic goal for their child. Parents were hugely frustrated that the bar is so low for what is expected of their children for employment from the schools. I found this little, that was exactly how I felt those parents felt that night. Intense frustration. Overall, students are not receiving meaningful transition plans. Parents are aware of that. The only exception is when a parent takes the lead and sets expectations about how these plans should be written and maybe even provides those assessment tools and resources that they want the staff to use. So when the school staff is pushed, then the parents can get a separate transition planning IEP, you know, and really get those assessments done for their child. Mostly parents and students were only given this informal questionnaire that equated to what we heard from the administrators. Most didn't really understand the formal transition process. The transition IEP is done at the same time as the annual review, that correlated. There's not enough time to do a good job in creating the master plan. Parents also generally felt that the agency role was not understood at the IEP meeting, and they often did not provide meaningful information that was helpful. I was able to communicate with our local ISC agents, thanks to Kim, and she said they've only recently begun to track what's happening to students out of high school. The agents have not been invited to very many IEPs. Mostly they haven't really had time, but they're also not being invited. With the addition of the new staff, Mary Rasher, they're hoping to be able to increase their participation. A guess is about 20 students with developmental disabilities age out of their county schools a year. That's from the ISCs. The majority of students who transition out from their perspective do not have funding, services, or jobs. So the perspective on funding was interesting. Parents seem to have a little bit better understanding that their child's meaningful life after high school was more dependent on them having some kind of employment than having waiver funding. A lot of them said, I don't even want to talk about that. You know, I want to talk about them having a job. School administrators seemed very focused on correlating quality of life outcomes to whether the student had waiver funding and agency support. We kept hearing that over and over. Well, why bother with these plans if they're not going to have the funding? Like, they really were believing that having waiver funding was their only key to having anything meaningful in their life. There seemed to be very little understanding from both the parent and the educator perspective that employment support could be had more readily because it's funded differently. It's mostly employment is in the communities generally funded by DRS and to the agencies. However, in Champaign County, we also have CCDDB funds that help with employment activities. There seemed to be very little understanding about the funds dispersed by the CCDDB to our community as a whole, and that those were funds that were actually circulating in the community that could help with such things as employment. They just kind of looked at me like, huh? I don't get that. So transition and adult supports in Champaign County. So I thought I would just kind of look at this a little bit. So if you're a person that is, for whatever reason, your individual might not be able to be employable. So non-employment day options. If you're not working in the community, what might you be doing? So in Champaign County, DSC is the major provider of day training. These are services for individuals who are not maybe working in the community. So how do you access that? Well, people need to have waiver funds to receive services. Private pay is not an option, but the CCDDB also provides substantial funding for adult services. But it's unclear to the community how or if new people can receive services under that grant. IAG does provide non-traditional day services in the community, but that's just for the few clients that they serve in group homes. That's a waiver service. CTF will be opening their advocacy center soon, and the CCDDB provides some funding for that. What they are saying is that they will use waiver funds, DT funds, and they'll accept private pay, but that's not currently operating right now. So this thing about the waiver, and we'll talk about that in a couple more slides, this perception that, again, if I don't have waiver funds, I can't access anything. And really, it's, you know, waiver funds, the way they're being used a lot in our community is being self-directed for personal support workers. So we don't have very many things that we can actually purchase with our waiver right now, and that's another area that we could possibly spend time discussing how to incentivize other services that can be purchased with waiver funds but through agencies. So employment, we have four agencies that are currently providing employment for people with developmental disabilities, DSC, and those are all the ways that you can pay for that. Community Choices, we don't take the waiver right now for employment. We're going to kind of look into that. UCP, United Cerebral Palsy, either DRS or they have some CCDDB funding. And Cunningham Children's Home, as far as I know, only has DRS funding.
Oh, they also have WIOA.
Okay, WIOA funding. Does that come through DRS as well or no?
No, it comes through the Regional Planning Commission is now the provider of our, the Workforce Investment
okay.
Office.
So,
in the same building.
Okay. And if any of these are incorrect on the other ones, let me know.
Jim, isn't that for a particular population? It's not necessarily people with DDs, but, right, the WIOA funding that Cunningham has?
Yeah, it's broader than simply developmental disabilities.
Okay, but they can include people.
Can include people with developmental
okay. That's good. And I've heard of one family, actually, that is going to be using that WIOA funding that fit into that category, and it's going to be starting with them on that. And the interesting thing about that is that those WIOA funding are actually going to pay this individual's hourly wage while they're getting that training. So I think that's made a kind of a difficult placement acceptable. So that's something new to the community.
Could you explain that last comment?
They're so under the new
of the worker?
Correct.
They can pay minimum wage for up to 240 hours of training.
Yeah. So
my understanding of the WIOA grant that Cunningham has. They call it their Vocational Options Program, and it's for youth. Well, it's for individuals 18 and older. And so it's, you know, it's open to not only, you know, students coming out of their schools, but just generally for the community. And that WIOA funding can be used to pay minimum wage for up to 240 hours of training at a given site, you know, with the understanding that if that individual is doing well in that placement, that that employer would consider hiring them off of that program. So it's a kind of a, intended to be a bridge to employment, and then they provide some coaching and other support services with that as well.
So the research has been consistent for more than two decades. Employers do not hire people who come that way.
Well, this is, I've heard of some of that research as well, and, you know, that's it, the federal WIOA Act must, the folks who put that together may not have been aware of that research,
but planners at the state agencies are aware of customized employment as a preferred option, that there's better chance of placement right. through that. So if we ever see any rewriting of our waivers with to include customized employment, we could have better results. Right. Also, to add that through their SILA waivers, IAG does have some job support too.
Okay.
So if there are people in this and CTF, so that if there okay. are individuals served through SILA, and so CTF and IAG both have a SILA presence in Champaign County,
yeah.
those people also have employment supports as one option.
Okay. Yeah. And they're using them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Sorry.
Just real quick.
Yep.
Yeah. The WIOA program that you referenced, Cunningham Children's Home, that's a WIOA grant that comes through the Regional Planning Commission. It's a youth contract. It is not specific for persons with developmental disabilities.
It's low income.
For the general population, and so they're applying it, and people can obviously that have disabilities apply to their program. So that may be part of the.
Is that low income?
It does, yes.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you for that. Thank you. I'm not going to read all this, but this was kind of the, you know, for so other ways that adults with developmental disabilities can access other things in the community that aren't waiver-based. And there's kind of a list of things there and how they're kind of funded. Again, decided to highlight that because of this sort of perception, again, that the schools kind of had that if you don't have the waiver, they kept calling it the golden ticket, then you can't have a meaningful life. And these are other organizations that have other funding and sources that you can access even if you don't have waiver services. And actually, they don't take waiver services. So CU Special Rec, Community Choices, PACE. And then I threw in Parkland College in there, does not provide any courses for people with IDD. It's been a trend for over probably a decade now that local community colleges have started to provide some kind of courses for people with IDD in their communities. About 10 years, Vicki Nicewander's here, and she spearheaded efforts to look at this in our community, and she could speak way more about it than I can. She put a lot of effort into that, and at the end of the day, Parkland College said, no, we are not going to provide those services. And Vicki, if I'm misspeaking, please correct me. Okay. So when you're writing a transition plan, you're supposed to look at those three categories, employment, and then post-secondary educational and continued training options, and independent living. So we have very few options on that post-secondary that are really tailored to people with IDD. So if you can fit into something that's happening in the community, fine and dandy, but we're not really, you know, doing that at least through our U of I, Parkland College, those kind of entities. All right, so more crisis of capacity on the horizon. So on my listening tour, service facilitation. Currently, there are two agencies who provide service facilitation for home-based waiver, the golden ticket, DSC and Community Choices. Both of these agencies are at capacity for providing this service. With the impending changes in the state's requirements for service facilitation, we heard Lynn talk briefly about the total utter confusion of where that's going. Providers are not willing to expand their services. You know, we don't really know what it's going to look like. So we had plans, I know, at Community Choices to expand and then decided to put that on hold until we figured out what was happening. It's unclear what will happen as people receive their award letters but then don't have local options for service facilitation. So that needs to be determined. So back to this, ability to spend waiver dollars in the community is really very limited unless they are self-managed. So self-managing requires families to find their own personal support workers and manage the day-to-day activities of their adult child. Parents can be PSWs, but that's not usually ideal. So even though more and more people are getting waiver funds, they're not having very many options on ways to spend those waiver dollars. If they're creative and can find personal support workers to work with them and train them and find meaningful things for their individuals to do in their lives, you know, that works for some. But for a lot of people, they're not able to manage at that level. It is a lot of work. And then, you know, we don't really have agencies that you can knock on their door and say, I have the waiver. Now can I purchase some services with that? So next steps, where are we going? Lots of opportunity for questions.
Could I make a comment before we move too far into questions and future about the role of puns? I think most everybody in this room has a personal relationship with puns or professional relationship with puns and knows that it's not a perfect instrument, but over the years it has come to be seen as a database for needs, for unmet needs assessment in the state and in the county. And because of the large levy that this county has for local funding for similar services, we need to be very careful about what the state sees when they look at Champaign County. So it's a requirement of our contracts for DDB-funded services for people with DD that they be enrolled on PUNS so that they're the needs which they may have that are not being met by long-term state funding through the waivers are recognized on that database. Another thing that just within the last year the Independent Service Coordination Unit has been doing for the DDB under contract is a determination of presumptive eligibility. It's good enough for us. But the DDB's funding guidelines, which are based on the statute, the 377 statute, require the eligibility criteria to match what DHS uses for their DD determinations. So we thought, who better than to make that determination than the people who make that determination for the state? So at this point, the services that you're funding for people who don't have waiver funding have that, you know, that's sort of in the entry, like all of the people being served with those dollars should be eligible for the waiver funded state services if they were selected from PUNS. And this was important because the state has a history of not providing funding in communities where they see the need is being met by the community's other resources, and that would effectively tax the taxpayers of Champaign County twice for the same services. So anyway, the role of PUNS is increasingly big, and even with our services.
I'm not shooting the messenger.
Good, but
believe me, I'm not shooting the messenger.
Okay, good, thank you.
And I will start out by saying that I am very disappointed. I've been gone for 30 years, and I would say that services have gone backwards rather than forwards in 30 years. And this is just a point. This just illustrates it to me more than anything else. I'm wondering about parent just-in-time resources, such as a hotline where they can call and get information about transition services. There's been several pieces that have indicated that parents can go to meetings where there are community service providers present, and they will hear about the services, but because they don't have a need at the moment, it just doesn't register with them. And then they don't know where to go after the meeting. And when they really do need have those questions, where do they go to get that information? It appears they're not getting it from their school. So where would they go for that kind of information?
A lot of them call me. So I get lots and lots of calls if they know that. Sheila Krein is here. She is a real resource in the community. So it's like you have to kind of, you know, get to support group meetings, the Down Syndrome Network, the CU Autism Network, the Autism Program. There's a new group called CU Able. They're mostly younger families in that. So parents finding other parents that can provide that. Again, at the TPC, we try to do some of these meetings, you know, community meetings, and then we get that information out through the schools. So parents will show up at those to get more information. But there isn't, go ahead. The expo, the Disability Expo. You know, they call DSC.
We have a contact person at DSC. Vicki Tolf is our contact person, and she and I just met with the family and teachers yesterday.
Okay. So it's not coordinated, though.
No.
So people have to have a sense to reach out and call somewhere and try to get more information. But part of it is they don't know what they don't know.
Right. And that's why I said it's more of a just-in-time thing where they all of a sudden realize that they heard, but they don't have any idea.
There's lots of resources on the internet about transition, you know, for sure. If you get to, you know, there's a lot of good websites.
So all of this is really good if you're not a parent from a low-income background,
right,
or you're an English-speaking parent.
Exactly.
Or you're a parent who hasn't been alienated by human services and school services all along.
Yes.
And I'm mostly worried about those parents.
Yep.
So I'm curious where we go with that.
I just want to add that I'm a parent who's not low income, who's fluent English native speaker.
You still have trouble.
And my son is 23. His IEP called for him to go into the Army, which I knew he wasn't qualified for because of medication, and they wouldn't take that off the IEP, mm-hmm, or to go to Parkland. And we've tried twice at Parkland and failed miserably. And the school kept pushing the optimism of how much potential my son had. And so it's very hard to go against wanting to believe that there's potential. And then when you discover there really isn't potential, and he had behavior disorders and developmental delays, then you really start to talk to everybody you know in order to find out what's in the community. And I probably called every agency in the community and have talked to most of the people around the table, just trying to figure things out. I'm well informed. Mm-hmm. So it's really a crisis, even for potentially very able, well-informed parents.
I just want to say I agree with what you're saying because I worked in a school. I was an educator. I was a special speech-language pathologist in the school setting while my son was there. And it was a confusing, frustrating process getting through transition. And it felt like it was almost impossible to put the puzzle together, all the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle at that time. And I don't think we've moved much beyond that at this point. And my son's 28 now, so.
If we're going to be talking about this, one thing I really need to say is that having worked in public schools in Champaign County, the school looks at things differently. They look at it as this child is aging out, and I'm not talking about teachers here, I'm talking about administrators. This child is aging out, therefore it won't be our responsibility any longer. And the special ed teacher is told, you know, don't put down anything there that, you know, that we might have to be responsible for. That's just reality. That's what happens. When you start talking about how parents access things, it's like Susan said. If you are lucky enough to know people who actually are in special ed or talking about those things or developmental services or community choices, if you're lucky enough to even know they exist when it comes to aging out, you look into everything you can look into. But you're exactly right. Most of the people that I worked with as a special ed teacher for 35 years, administrators would say, we are not going to be responsible for that, so why should we plan for it? It's just something that, I mean, it's an exercise in futility for us. It's just taking our time. We still have educators out there, and I use that term loosely. We still have educators out there who, were there not a law that special ed had to be provided, they would not provide it, period. So when it comes to families that don't have the information, a teacher is told to give those folks the information. A teacher who is so busy with IEPs and annual reviews and everything else that goes with that, and yet their primary concern is that student. What's going to happen to that student when they leave? And we can talk about programs, and we do, but the reality is that if you are not from a background that has something to do with this very thing, you are not going to know who to go to. The first thing we did as a board to try to address this was the Resource Expo. The Resource Expo has helped tremendously. I know it has. I've been told by many people that it has helped them find what they needed to find. Again, though, you have to know about the Resource Expo. So if we fund those kinds of things to make sure that gets out into the community, I think it's helpful. But again, we are looking at a separated system. We've got an educational system. We've got a governmental system. We've got a parent system. We've got all of these things, but the actual cohesiveness of that does not exist at this point. So, you know, you feel after many years that you're just banging your head against a wall or shouting out into the night, you know, I need this for my child. My child needs this. And people look at parents like that and say, yes, they do. And that's the end. And that's the end. We have to somehow, and there are very hard-working people who are trying to bridge that gap. Very, very hard. All the people sitting out here are doing it, and I'm sure everybody up here is doing it. Our government, especially in Illinois, looking at the funding, is not doing it. They're just not doing it. And they get away with it over and over and over again. I've done this forever. I would love to think that there's one answer to this, but there isn't. We just keep saying the same things, wanting the same things, and ending up with someone who has absolutely no right, in my opinion, to make a decision at a governmental level about whether or not my child gets what he needs. My child is 42. He's got good service. I don't want anyone here to think that the service that is being provided right now to the people who are getting those services is not doing what they should do. I think they are. They just are overwhelmed, just like the parents are.
So one avenue that I think is sometimes overlooked, and I'm not sure if the transition group is talking to people like this, but oftentimes the churches, especially in the African-American community, are really an important source of information. And I'm wondering if you're reaching out to any of the churches to get the information to them about what's available in the community so the parents will hear it there, too.
Not that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. And then I don't know if there are any other groups. We've had where I was in Madison, we had several groups for non-English-speaking families that they belong to. They were often encouraged to disseminate information around transition as well. Basically, it was reaching out to parents where they're most likely to be seen It's the medical clinics, it's the churches, it's the food pantries, all those support services, and providing the information there.
Yeah, again, we haven't done that to date.
And I'm not trying to give you more to do.
The only other thing I'd ask about is, with all the waiting lists for community employment, what's happening in the schools to get students significant employment experiences prior to graduation or aging out?
And first of all, one of the things that there isn't really very long waiting lists on the adult agency side for employment. I've found that you can get employment support relatively quickly, not like the first day that you call, but I mean, you know, within weeks to a month or so. What's your experience?
Yeah, for the most part. And some people we work with a little bit longer, working on soft skills, because some people are more employment ready than others. Mm-hmm.
So that's what, again, I wanted to kind of break this idea that if you didn't have the waiver, you can't have anything, because our that we have four agencies now that are doing employment. And I know when I talked to UCP at the expo, they said that they had no waiting list. I know Community Choices, we have a waiting list, but, you know, generally within a month or so, 2 months.
Yeah.
Two months or so, you can start getting some employment experience. So just wanted to make sure people knew that.
If I can, real quick, just if that's going to become even more challenging, though, with the new changes in the WIOA regulations that are going to make it difficult, because you can argue the merits of subminimum wage or not, but with the rates they currently pay, our ability to do those community experiences, they're expected to be a community work experience and not a subminimum wage experience under the new WIOA. So that transition thing as far as servicing those kids and getting that vocational leave and assessments could be much more challenging for us, because we create a path to the community environment and the rates aren't going to afford us to do that. So that's a real challenge for us going forward.
So
to get those community experiences for those kids.
Right. And I'm actually more interested in you not having to do that, as in the schools actually coordinating mm-hmm. that and doing
well,
that.
To respond absolutely. To that.
And also, that would extend the transition further to make sure the transition's in place so we can
right.
maintain it. Once the school has done that, you're right, starts earlier.
And again, those work experiences that are currently happening in the school, they have work sites that are, you know, they run some kids through, but they kind of put kids in different buckets, those that they really think can work, and then kind of the middle bucket that they might get some, and then there's sort of a bucket of kids that they don't think will be employable, and they really don't get much unless that parent advocacy part of it steps up and says, I want my child to have those work experiences. And they have to fight and fight and fight and fight to get them into those experiences and then to be believed that they really might be employable.
Chandra, I think you have a comment.
Another thing when we were at our state association was expanding partnerships with actual businesses. Oftentimes what we learned in our findings was that employment services here are saturated. So we know that there is one organization that hires lots of people that have developmental disabilities as well as intellectual disabilities, and they're saturated. And so the idea when we talked at our state association meeting was, how can we expand the capacity by meeting with the chamber and begin presenting the information about employment first, so that small businesses can actually begin to employ people as well. So it just won't be on the parents, but also the schools being informed. And another thing the schools acknowledged was that just like we talked about the coordination of who knows what, having like transition specialists and building capacity for individuals like Jim, even more countywide, was something that they found that would be very helpful in actually training individuals to become transition specialists.
So the training's been around for many, many years. It is disappointing. I guess the last question I have is, transition is often thought about as serving children with intellectual disabilities, autism, and physical disabilities. And I hear very little about transition for students with significant emotional disabilities. And I don't even see anything in the documentation about wraparound services or anything like that. So I'm curious as to what's going on in that area.
Yeah, I can speak a little bit just to, you know, the fact that, you know, as you suggest, that transition, that a transition plan is required for any student with an IEP. Mm-hmm. So all types of disabilities are covered with that. And, you know, I have opportunity through, you know, my work with one of the things I do as a transition specialist is help coordinate the STEP program, which is sort of a specialized cooperative work program for students with disabilities. It's a statewide program that's funded by the Division of Rehab Services. Not every state has a program like STEP, but Illinois has had it for quite a while, and so that's one aspect of transition that Illinois, you know, has had for a number of years and has been helpful to a number of students. You know, that program, and, you know, it serves not only students with developmental disabilities, but students with learning disabilities, students with emotional disabilities, et cetera, et cetera. And the way that program works, just to give a quick thumbnail sketch up, is we serve about 100 students countywide every year in that program. Roughly about a third of those students are in paid employment, and the other two-thirds are in unpaid internships. But it's, you know, it's work experience where the students get school credit for that work experience, and where various supports are wrapped around them, such as job coaching or other kinds of supports. And there's usually a classroom component as well where work skills are discussed. And in Champaign County, just to give you an idea, that program it's made available countywide. Not all of the high schools participate, Centennial and Central being the two that don't participate in it. However, the Champaign Young Adult Program, serving students with primarily developmental disabilities age 18 to 22, does participate. So that's one little pocket of the Champaign schools that participates in STEP. But again, that's pretty much strictly, well, almost exclusively students with developmental disabilities that that program serves. But the STEP program itself serves all students with disabilities, are eligible to participate. And one nice thing about the program, besides the students get work experience and many of them actually gain employment through that program, is that it's a link with the Division of Rehab Services, which can be a valuable transition resource. You know, they can pay for community college and many other kinds of, you know, vocational training experiences and also help with job placement post high school. So that's one thing that's going on countywide. And students with emotional disabilities are kind of a growing population, as I'm sure you're aware. Yeah, and so in addition to kind of the programs within the high schools, there's also, you know, Circle Academy that serves some students with that disability, and the Pavilion School, and those Cunningham has the WIOA grant, not only the one that serves young adults post school, but they have a WIOA grant that serves their in school youth, and then the Pavilion has at different times over the years participated in the STEP program, not consistently every year, but they've participated some during my 15 years with that program. So,
and Cheryl, there's also we'll talk about it at the Mental Health Board meeting a little bit, because it's actually linking to this work is one of the potential priorities for funding for the Mental Health Board tonight. And Chandra's standing by in case I get the details wrong, but we are in a region, a four or six county region, is it four? Where the state is doing a demonstration project called Choices. It's a coordinated care project. It targets, I think at this moment, it's really strictly children with DCFS involvement, but it was to include, you know, more children at risk, and it features wraparound. So, and that work is actually, they came in with this right around the time that our Access Initiative project was entering its last year, where they're planning for sustainability anyway. So they took a lot of the results from that work, and wraparound was featured in the access work too.
And it's not just DCFS involvement. There's two ways children can enter. One is through DCFS, and one is if they're Medicaid recipients and their child is taking mm-hmm. psychotropic medication.
At this point, are they serving those children, though, or are they all DCFS?
Yes,
my experience is that they were serving those as well. I've had quite a few.
Well, that was the plan, but the last I heard was they weren't getting past the DCFS cohort.
My experience is I've had children that have gotten supports that weren't DCFS involved, which was nice because they were families that, you know, had a child that had Medicaid and needed psychiatric treatment. So
the mention of DCFS makes me wonder about the involvement of the juvenile justice system in helping them become aware of what's going on and them participating in planning. Are they at all engaged? Okay.
Not on this side, but on the behavioral health side, they are.
Just one comment. One thing that I'm proud of that the DD Board and Mental Health Board have done is to fund a dual diagnosis program that's granted through Community Elements, now Rosecrans, that meets the needs of about 30 young adults with developmental delays and mental health. Before that program began, there was no way to get services unless you were Medicare or Medicaid eligible.
Yes, Sheila.
This is a little bit off topic, but the idea of getting a job, how important it is in school. My son would have been in the pocket where they would not have sought employment for him, but I pushed and they did, and he's been at his job nearly 3 years. And the big thing is, well, not all the benefits of employment and the money, so you can purchase services and the things you need, but of getting SSDI and relying on that versus SSI. One point I want to make is when parents retire or they pass away, their children can receive some SSDI. But if you're on a lot of retirement systems like the University of Illinois, you do not get that money. You don't get
That's
any
a good
money
point.
Until the child passes, until the parent passes away. And then that's only if they could still be considered part, you know, beyond their income tax. So like we're doing this juggling right now because I hope by the time my husband passes away, we might get some services for a group home or something, but you have to keep all these avenues open. And like I still have to be able to, you know, call my child and then he's dependent on my income tax.
Right.
And otherwise, right. You know, you just break it up and the whole thing with the special needs trust and all that. So it's kind of overwhelming for long term funding. But if they have SSDI on their own accord, that is some money that
That's an important point, that there are just so many balls to juggle in the air and so much to know, and it's so hard to understand all of it, even for people who are very educated and very involved and have access to resources, let alone families who don't have any of that equipment.
Just one final comment. You also have to be able to work enough to earn over $7,000 to qualify for SSDI. So if you leave high school and you're not successful in maintaining a job for any time period, you will never qualify for SSDI. And that means that you will, through SSI, get some money, but not as much as you might have through SSDI. So it's a vicious circle.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you for coming. This is such a huge issue. It's such a top priority, I think, that whole transition planning issue. Thank you. Very good information. Okay, do we have any integration transition success stories today?
Hi, my name is Laura Bennett. I'm from Developmental Services Center, and actually I think this is a very nice segue for me, the presentation previously, but my success story is about a transition and integration and cooperation with the schools. So we had a young man who exited schools last May, and during the year prior to his graduation, DSC was involved in attending his IEPs and getting to know him. He also participated in a vocational experience at DSC, And as we realized that we would be able to serve him, he did not have the golden ticket. DDB is funding his support. He transitioned into our agency, and during the last couple of weeks of his schooling, we participated with him at his job that the schools were able to get him, where he was folding pizza boxes at Papa John's, and that was just a couple of hours a week. But we joined him and his aide and got to meet the management of Papa John's, and then we were able to have a seamless transition. Once he exited school, we were able to maintain his employment and support. He maintained his own employment, but we were able to maintain the support, and we are providing support to him at his job currently, and I'm really pleased to say that he's actually added another shift. So what began as a one-day-a-week experience or job is now 2 days a week, and we continue to provide that support. He's a young man who also has some physical limitations, so we help him with some of those supports within the space itself. And the management team there is also very supportive, and his coworkers are very supportive also. So it was a very nice the way transition should work, where we collaborated with the schools and we really got to know him, and we were able to provide the ongoing support, and DDB is supporting him and our efforts with him. So I wanted to let you know about that.
Great, thank you.
I'm Kathy Kessler from Rosecrans, and Miranda Hoffman is our service coordinator for the developmental disability and mentally ill clients that Carolyn or that Mrs. Fowler just talked about. We recently had a client that we were uncertain if they met the criteria of the program, and they had the diagnosis, but as far as the IQ, we weren't certain on that. So we worked with Ron and Heather at DSC to see about getting a psychological done on this individual, got the assessment set up, provided the information they needed. Their psychologist saw the individual, and both DSC staff and our staff were very surprised that the individual did have an IQ that put him within the criteria of the program. So we were very, very pleased that we're going to be able to provide services to him. Thank you.
Okay, moving on. There is a decision memorandum in our packet for regarding cancellation of the Autism Society of Illinois contract. This has kind of been an ongoing concern for a while. Basically, and I thought maybe Lynn would be here to explain this, but I'll try the best I can to get explain all the pieces. The CCDDB has contracted with the Autism Society to support activities of local parent professional network, the CU Autism Network. The Autism Society of America has recently notified the Autism Society of Illinois that they are no longer going to be affiliated with them. Because the Autism, the CU Autism Network is not a not-for-profit organization, we are no longer going to be able to keep our contract viable with them until or unless at some point they are able to coordinate their program with another provider that is a not-for-profit. I hope I have that correct. So at this time, we're going to have to entertain a motion about canceling the contract with the CU Autism Network.
I move that we authorize staff to issue an amendment to the Autism Society of Illinois contract to reduce the contract maximum to $4,000 with no further payment due.
Second.
All in, do we have any discussion? Any further discussion on this? Okay. Stephanie, do we need to do a roll call because this involves dollars? Okay. Roll call, please.
Joy Still?
Aye.
David Happ?
Aye.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell?
Aye.
Deb Roush?
Aye. The motion is passed. We are going to amend our contract and reduce the contract to what has already been spent for our current fiscal year to $4,000 on this, and there will be no further payment. Okay, on page 12 of the packets, we have information about the CCDDB and the CCMHB looking into an organizational assessment. And Lynn?
Sorry about that. Did you talk about the autism study?
Yes, we passed.
Because
since we don't even know if we can get a signature back from the organization, I made another copy of the amendment so that we can do our part today, if that's all right with staff. Okay. For the organizational assessment, I guess I do have one proposal. I asked them to look to streamline it a little bit. I would rather not spend a whole lot of money on it, It proposed everything. It was all the stuff we've been talking about, which would make the work better, or at least create some suggestions for us to make the work better. So anyway, I'm waiting for a reduced proposal. My hope is not to add too much to our budget or cause too much disruption for Nancy moving things from one line to the other. Right? If we're not spending as much in personnel, we could request a budget transfer. We would start here with that request, and we would also make that request at the county board level to cover the cost of this contract. But we're not so far along that I know that we need to do anything like that. So anyway.
For the purposes of discussion, I'd like to move that we approve the executive director negotiating in executing a contract with approval of the presidents of the CCDDB and CCMHB for external evaluation of the organization and its operations.
Second.
Okay. Is there discussion? Yes.
Well,
Dr. Fallon.
I'm not on the DD board, but I as a representative of the MH board, I've met with Lynn and with a number of different evaluators. As a new executive director with a prior director being in place for 16 years, we thought it was very important to do a good analysis of the organization for moving forward and ensuring that the operations are as efficient and efficacious as possible. And that's why this motion came to be today.
Yes. Good, I agree. Anybody else? Because this involves dollars, do we roll call it?
There's no amount of money specified in this motion.
All in favor of approving the executive director negotiating this contract?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? It passes. Approved.
There aren't any materials associated with this agenda item. I sent copies of samples of how we might use a program summary for a DD program and then also for mental health programs. And I didn't get a whole lot of comments back which suggested that maybe people are okay with the current system, but we can have this discussion on a continuing basis too. We would like to get ourselves set up to do the evaluation of applications before the system launches so that we know that our application instructions match what we're expecting from agencies and how that ties into what we're looking at. So if you had any concerns or if you felt like one thing I wonder about is if there's too much analysis of the budgets, because I like doing that part, but I think I just get like a little bit hypnotized by percentages. I don't know if it's useful to you in the process of making decisions. So it's really an open discussion. If you don't have really strong opinions to share today, we can get back to it.
Moving on to old business, do we have an employment first update?
Hi, I'm Becca Obachowski from Community Choices, and Annette is here as well. So we have been meeting with businesses. It's been a bit slow with the holiday season. I think a lot of the businesses are a bit overwhelmed with with sort of holiday preparations. We were with Annette's support, able to schedule a training for customized employment with Griffin and Hammes. Which is scheduled for February
14th, yes. 15th, and 16th. And that will be open to not only adult service mm-hmm. providers, but the school job developers as well.
Yep. We were also able to just continue to make a few tweaks to the training that we have developed, some with the support of Brian Degg, the consultant that DSC has hired, sort of incorporating some of the feedback that that he gave us when he was here in November. We also yesterday or Monday that we did a presentation to the University of Illinois group Enactus to sort of get sort of a business perspective and some feedback from them. So we'll be working on some of the suggestions that they had to, again, just continue to make tweaks and really try to make that training something that is going to be most beneficial to employers to really sort of meet their needs as well as the needs of service providers. Any questions?
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay, on page 20, we have the draft FY 2018 CCDDB allocation criteria.
Since Unemployment First, I just like, as you know, I continue to serve on the statewide Employment First Task Force, and we met about a week and a half ago, and I know Lynn sat in and listened in on that, and I just wanted to report. It's, you know, it's a long process, but there's the work was broken into four committees, and those committees all made their final, pretty much final reports to the group as a whole. Because the exciting thing, I think it was this week, they were going to be presenting to all the different department heads because that'll be affected by this. And they had a brief time to do that. And so part of our last meeting was sort of them prepping and doing their presentations in front of us so we could critique that, because it's real critical of how that's responded to and if and how it goes forward from there. So the final report is very, very close to being done after that report's made. And you know, the challenge we have is that under the state of Illinois Employment First, developmental disabilities is just one component. It's meant for all disabilities, and that makes it much more challenging for us because we're competing for the employment activities with veterans and some people with, I think, higher abilities to do some of the work that we're competing for. And so we have a strong presence on there representing developmental disabilities in the committee, and so our issues have been heard quite clearly, and so that report, as soon as it's done, we'll make sure that's presented to you. Thank you.
Sorry about that, Dale.
I'm sorry, I forgot one very important thing. We have had two people from within our sheltered workshop get jobs in the community over the past few weeks, and it can be really challenging when, you know, again, people are used to their family member being in a very protected setting. So We had several meetings with one parent in particular, just in terms of safety getting to and from work and making sure that they could still come back to Clark Road on during the hours that they weren't working. The parent agreed to 2 days and within 3 weeks was willing to let her family member go up to 3 days of working in the community. So everybody's happy. This person is the happiest vacuumer we've ever seen. And he's already gotten positive feedback from, you know, from his coworkers.
Great, thank you. Okay. The draft FY 2018 CCDDB allocation criteria is on page 13 of the packets, and we've seen this third time this year, and we've just, it's been fine-tuned, tweaked just a little bit, and I do believe it's in its final form.
I hope so. Did we
get but that? Approval's necessary.
So,
it's out of there, yes.
There are some people in the peanut gallery who contributed really helpful comments to this process, so I want to say thank you. You know who you are.
So does anybody have a motion?
I move that we approve the allocation, priority, and decision support criteria as described in our memorandum.
Second. Discussion?
I apologize. This is probably the first time that I have read this whole thing, and I'm not going to hold up its approval, but I am concerned that there are pieces in here that are continuing to focus on the concept of readiness and training when we know that people can be employed without readiness and training. And so I'm worried that we're going to perpetuate a system where people never get to the community employment.
Lynn, do we have time to revamp this before we do this? Is this something that we should table then? Do we have another?
You can pass it with changes. You can modify. If I have specific changes that you want to add right now.
So in employment services, I'd rather see that we have a priority in job development, matching, and job coaching, and innovative employment supports, and not a priority in job readiness training.
So if we just pull those three words?
Yes.
Is there another instance of that?
Can you tell me what page and paragraph you're on?
17 at the top.
The only other question I have is the priority under non-work community life and flexible support and the inclusion of functional academics and vocational training. I'm not sure where that fits in adult services because I think of vocational training mostly, well, maybe I'm not exactly sure what's referred to here as vocational training, but vocational training I see as under the purview of the schools. And functional academics, I see, is under the purview of the schools, too. So it depends on the population and the age of the population.
Okay.
But it's the same concept in that I'd rather get people actually out into the community living and working rather than continually preparing them to do that because we know that they can be prepared while they're in the community. And I don't know what those two are, so...
You know, I have to think about that a little bit before I would change anything on that. So, I mean, those are excellent comments on it. but I think I'd like to think about it.
Well, we pretty much have agreement on the job readiness language at the top of page 17 in under employment services and supports. I'm going to suggest then that we approve the bulk of this document. And revisit potentially?
Yeah. So I'll just reiterate, I don't want to hold up the approval of the document. I just really want to go on record more than anything else to express my concerns that we spend a lot of time preventing people from getting employment and in the community when they could be there and receive their training
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm. I understand this point.
Can I talk? You have a motion on the table. Is that okay?
Can't you talk?
Well, Lynn, is this time sensitive or can this wait another month?
We're launching there's a NOFA right now for applications, and then we open the system for agencies to start making application on January 4 or 5. It's quite soon. And so one option I could offer you, but I would be taking it away from the Mental Health Board maybe, is that we have booked this room for the evening of December 21st, so we could meet again for discussion then. Mm. What we could do, though, is we can prefer best practices, we can prefer evidence-based and evidence-informed practices in the selection, in your decisions about what to fund. So we could leave this as is, and then just note that evidence supports not doing the job readiness in a sheltered setting.
And I actually think you do have reference to evidence-based practices in this document. Okay.
Are you comfortable with that?
I am, as long as it's very clear where my priorities lie.
So then no changes to the document? Or the one?
Yeah. I'm sensitive to the time frame, and so I don't think I'm going to ask to have the document upheld to make changes. No, I know I'm not going to. I just, this is a big issue for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So to be clear, the motion is to accept the document as currently written at this point. Point?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Approved. Okay, under bold business, item C, the draft FY 2018 CCMHB allocation criteria is included for information only. Okay, and then moving on to page 29, there is a document, our draft three-year plan with FY 2017 objectives on page 29. I move that we approve the final draft CCDDB three-year plan for FY 16 through 18 with one-year objectives for 2017 attached to this memorandum.
I second.
All in favor? Oh, sorry, any discussion? In favor?
Aye.
Opposed? It is approved.
Before you put the motion on to the side.
Okay. Okay.
Before you make a motion and have discussion, I want to share that, apologize for the language. I think I indicate in here that this lower cost was negotiated, and that's really a misrepresentation of what happened. I had a number of conversations with the organizer of the festival, and she, in turn, was speaking with the leadership of the festival about, on our behalf, about concerns. And they came up with a reduced price, and before it could come out of my mouth, she said, we know that those cost is not the only issue. So just if that helps you in consideration of sponsoring another film, they realize that this is not entirely about the money, that it's also about whether this is the best place for you to invest in anti-stigma efforts. And I want to echo what Chandra mentioned before, that a major theme at our state conference was getting communities ready to do inclusion of people with disabilities. So we know that anti-stigma is very important for best results for everything else we do, but recognition from the festival that this may not be what you choose to do right now. So anyway,
I have grown to believe that anti-stigma efforts that we support should really be related to our self-advocates and should be embedded in their daily lives. And they should be efforts that those folks, our individuals, do front and center in the community every day. I think that's the best way to combat stigma, is that the community at large, as much as possible every day throughout the day, sees able people participating to the fullest. And that's why I don't really believe that the film festival is the best use of our funding, even if it's just $6,000 or at a reduced level from previous times. I think, gosh, there are a number of ways we could put that $6,000 to use to help support individuals be a real presence in the community here instead of on film.
I agree.
Okay. Does somebody would like to make a motion? Or we've already moved, right?
No,
we did not move. We had discussion before we moved. I'm sorry.
I wanted to make sure my comments were not when you had a motion on the table.
Is there a motion?
I'll read the motion. Motion to approve up to $6,322.50 as the CCDDB share of the CCMHB approved share of up to $8,677.50 to sponsor an anti-stigma film and concurrent anti-stigma activities at the 2017 Roger Ebert's Film Festival.
Second. Discussion? Okay. All in favor?
Well, I need a
roll call. Oh, roll call money. Sorry.
David Happ?
Nay.
Cheryl Hanley Maxwell?
No.
Joy Still?
No.
Deb Roush?
No.
Item F, our meeting schedule is attached on page 38 to 40. And again, did you want to? No, go ahead. I was just going to move on.
The allocation timeline is the second part of the schedule. It shows you sort of these are important moments for us when we need to move things forward so we can, you know, present you with draft documents for a long time, but this will show you why we were in a hurry today with the allocation priorities, and I apologize for that, but But anyway, this there also now includes those optional times when we have this room available if you do need to have further discussion, and or if you want to schedule a study session on a topic further out, you can see when we already have the room.
I'd just like to note that because of various reasons, we moved to separate the CCDB from the CCMHB meetings by about 8 hours. And I would like to encourage us to try and schedule some study sessions with the two boards together, because we really do work together, even though we may have slightly different foci. We still serve many of the same people. And I'd also like to encourage cross-representation at the Mental Health Board meeting when possible.
Okay, the last item is that there is a Ligas Family Advocate Program acronym sheet included in the back. And I think that was on, we had that last month, too, didn't we, the same sheet? It's good. Good information to try to keep up with those acronyms as they change.
At the risk of sounding like I don't know much, which is almost every time I speak, one of the things that I'd like to know is, what does WIOA stand for?
Workforce
Innovation
and Opportunities Act.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, it looks like we may be ready to adjourn. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Meeting adjourned.